Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
Have you ever wanted to learn a new language? Maybe you were inspired by a recent international trip, became obsessed with a foreign film or TV show, wanted to communicate better with a loved one, or just felt like developing a new skill. With Rosetta Stone, learning a new language is easier than you thought. Rosetta Stone has been a trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered, including Spanish, French, Japanese, Dutch, and more. Learning is immersive and designed for long-term retention, so you fully learn to speak, listen, and even think in that language. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Everybody, welcome to a special edition of Power Bombshells. I am Sam, and that is Mel. And today we are joined by a very special guest. We have Professor Bridget Carr joining us. She is a clinical professor of law and director of the Human Trafficking Clinic at the University of Michigan Law School. Professor Carr has dedicated her career to advocating for the rights of human trafficking victims and advancing comprehensive domestic and international anti-trafficking policies. Her work focuses on driving paradigm shifts in the way human trafficking victimization is perceived and addressed, and helping reintegrate victims by developing legal solutions that address the complex issues of coercion and victimization around the around compelled service and its aftermath. We are very delighted and grateful to have Bridget with us today. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And so as you, if you are a regular viewer of Power Bombshells, you know that since January, we have been covering Janelle Grant's lawsuit against Vince McMahon, John Laurinaitis, and the WWE. We've also been covering various things with Vince McMahon for the last few years. And we thought, because this is a topic that is so important, but maybe there's not a lot of maybe you don't know where to go get this information and things like that, we wanted to bring in an expert on this field, or in this field rather, to come speak with us today. And we have some questions for her, and hopefully you will find this enlightening and maybe help you understand a very complex situation a little bit better. So I'll start with our first question for you. So can you describe exactly what constitutes human trafficking, and tell us how prevalent it is in the United States, especially among adults? Because I think when people hear human trafficking, they think, oh, that happens in that country over there, or that happens because there are people in this country who should not be here, and they're the ones perpetrating this. But obviously, that's not the case. And if you would answer or talk about that, please.
Sure. That's a great question. And I think just to give folks some background and how I know what I'm talking about, because I think in this space, there's lots of people that talk about trafficking who don't actually know anything about trafficking.
Right.
So I am a clinical law professor at the University of Michigan. So my job is to teach law students how to be lawyers. And I do that through a class that's 7 credits. And in the class, students stand in my shoes under my bar license, and we together represent survivors of human trafficking.
Wow.
So it's kind of like the residency version, you know, like the how we do residency at law school.
Sure.
And so I have, over the years, by doing this work, represented hundreds and hundreds of survivors of human trafficking, both sex and labor, foreign national and U.S. citizens, and men, women, and children. And so that's when I'm speaking about trafficking, I'm speaking about it from this deep history of representing survivors in all types of cases. So I find that most people really misunderstand what human trafficking is, partially because of the word trafficking, and they think it requires transportation, and it doesn't. You can be raised in one town and never leave that town and be a victim of human trafficking. Mm-hmm. Trafficking really is compelled service. It's when there's some vulnerability that you have. That vulnerability could be that you don't have access to enough money, education, you want to come to the United States, or if you're an elite athlete, it can actually be that you've trained for so long, and then you want access to, let's say, the Olympics. And if that's a coercive work environment to put you through there, it can be that. So it doesn't have to be sort of vulnerability in the ways we always conventionally think about it. So you have some type of vulnerability. Someone has some type of power over you. That can be someone super duper powerful, right? Like some of these executives that we're seeing being indicted for sex trafficking, or it can just be someone in your community who has a little bit more power than you, right? And then they want to profit off of you or save some money. This is a really key, right? They want to get a commercial benefit from you. And so they might force you to clean their house and you don't pay them, or you force them to stay with you and you force them to clean for you and cook for you. And you threaten them that if they're undocumented, you're going to call immigration, have them deported. And so it's all these different ways that power and control are used over vulnerability in a commercial context that's what human trafficking is. And so I often say to folks, if you think your community doesn't sell drugs, then it likely doesn't sell people. And very few people think that their community doesn't have drugs for sale. And so really anyone listening to this, I've worked cases in major metropolitan cities and tiny, tiny small towns. The reality is that in almost every community, there's someone willing to use their power over someone else's vulnerability and compel them into service.
Yeah. And so, and I think that's why, and maybe, can you talk a little bit about the distinction between human trafficking and sex trafficking? Because I think people think they are interchangeable terms when they're actually not.
They are not. And in fact, when we use them as synonyms, we actually make labor trafficking victims invisible. So human trafficking has two different types, sex trafficking and labor trafficking. So both of those things fall under the broader umbrella of human trafficking. Mm-hmm. So I represent survivors of human trafficking because I represent people who are both sex trafficked and labor trafficked. But if I were to open a shelter for girls under the age of 18 who are US citizens who have been sold for sex, I can't call that a human trafficking shelter. That's a sex trafficking shelter because I'm not actually providing services for all types of human trafficking victims. So you're totally right. They're not synonyms. It's actually one of my biggest pet peeves when people use them as synonyms.
Yes, I can imagine. There's definitely a lot of confusion, I think, between the two. So it's also important to point out that human trafficking doesn't necessarily always lead to sex trafficking, where I think people that, which is why I think people confuse the two, because the assumption is, oh, well, if you're trafficking a human, it's for sexual purposes, when that's not necessarily the case.
Right. Well, I think it actually makes us, it eases our potential guilt, because the reality is most people are going to say they don't buy sex. I mean, people buy sex, but they're going to say they don't buy sex. So they're not at risk of using the labor services of a sex trafficking victim. But the reality is I use the labor and services of labor trafficking victims all the time. Could be the clothes I'm wearing, the iPhone I'm carrying, right? The car I'm driving. All of us consume goods and services made by exploited labor. People don't want to own that. Like, it's hard for me to own that. I've devoted my life's work to helping survivors of human trafficking. But that's just the reality of our economic system. And so I think one of the reasons people like to talk about human trafficking as only sex trafficking is because it makes them feel less guilty.
That's an excellent point. I'd actually never thought of it in that way, but yeah, because it is. You really are living in a society where it is, where we're reliant on that without even realizing it. And so
I like that you make the distinction between like when you're talking on your website and some of the articles that you've written and the things you participated in is it's capitalized because everything has been capitalized. It's capitalized use of another person for many gains.
Right.
And I think that I like the change of verbiage. I like that idea because I'm a word nerd. I like that the idea that you have taken it and reframed it for people to really understand. And I urge people to go check out Professor Carr's bio because she's got a lot of really fun and interesting stuff. Not fun, but stuff that will make you think about these things And it will be very helpful and supplemental to this conversation as well, because there's so much more. It's so broad and it is next door. And I mean, you and I being in the same state, I'm in a tiny little town, you know, you're in a big college town, but I'm sure the college towns draw that sort of stuff. So
yes,
it's everywhere.
Yeah. Yes, definitely. That's something that Mel and I talk about a lot, is that this type of that abuse and these things are happening. I was like, it could be at your grocery store. It could be where you buy coffee. It could be anywhere that you are doing business. These type of things could be happening. And so how prevalent, or I guess how common would you say that human trafficking is in the workplace? Because I think when people hear, they don't associate that with work. And you know, obviously this kind of leads into some of the stuff with Janelle Grant, because obviously she was an employee WWE, and she in her lawsuit alleges that some of these things were happening in the workplace, in the WWE headquarters. So is human trafficking something that is prevalent in the workplace?
So we don't have any reliable evidence-based data on prevalence in the United States. And you're going to say, but wait, I heard that this city is the number one for this, or that city is number one for that. I have no clue why these cities are competing for this number one distinction. It's not like if you're actually number one, some like pot of money and secret like tactical law enforcement force drops out of the sky.
Right.
Also, the reality is we just don't know. Without any good prevalence data to tell us what's happening nationally, we don't know where hotspots are. We don't know who's number one. And we also don't know when there are spikes. So there's a narrative around certain sporting events that like the Super Bowl brings it into town and that sort of things. And I think there's lots of damage things built into the Super Bowl myth that make us feel better about trafficking, but we just don't know. And so if you're asking me to give you some number about how prevalent it is in the workplace, I can't tell you that. But can I tell you that the majority of my clients were trafficked in a workplace setting? Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, well, that is an excellent answer. And I think that, and I think that people, we do, because you see these headlines, oh, this place is, you know, this is where, you know, these crimes happen the most. And so, that is kind of how it's fed to us as like, this is avoid that city because this is where that happens. Or so they think that, you know, and again, like this, because I was under the impression that the Super Bowl was one of the most trafficked events in the US, because that's how it has been framed the last few years. And so that's, and even I was under the assumption that the Super Bowl was, you know, the most trafficked, you know, one of the most trafficked events in the US, but then, you know, how do you quantify that? And how do you,
Other piece about that is that the Super Bowl myth really feeds into things we want to be true about trafficking. One, it's really only talk about sex trafficking, right? Like they're not saying, warning, all the people serving you, like handing you your beer and your hot dog at the stadium or cleaning your hotel rooms are trafficked, right? Like we're making labor trafficking victims invisible because we say human trafficking spikes, not sex trafficking spikes.
Sure.
So already we're making labor invisible. But the second thing that happens, and then I think is equally horrible, is that we're actually saying to communities, hey, don't worry. Your husband's dad's brothers, uncles, they don't buy sex. It's those people who come in from other communities who are creating a demand for sex trafficking in your community. And guess what? You only have to worry about sex trafficking on the one day a year that the Super Bowl shows up.
Right.
And so, And people love that, right? There's a comfort in that, like normally it's not a problem in my community. It's only a problem this one day of year. And I can marshal my resources and hand out soap and put it in hotel rooms and pat myself on the back that I solved the problem. When reality, if you want to work on trafficking issues, you want to reduce vulnerability in community. You want to raise wages. You want to make sure there's affordable housing. You want to advocate for universal healthcare, right? Like that's how we reduce trafficking. And, but it's just not as sexy. And I can't sell that as well as saying like, watch out, the Super Bowl is super scary. Hand out some soap.
Right. Yes.
It's the pink ribbon, what I like to call the pink ribbon syndrome, because if people only knew how little of that money goes to actual research, it's just criminal. Well,
there are very large companies that they will pinkwash things. They will sell you for the month of October pink gear and say, oh, we're donating this amount of proceeds, or they won't tell you the actual amount that they're donating and things like that. But yes, it's definitely one of those. You can do this one little thing and feel good about it, and then you can.
That's
move
America
on.
In a nutshell, isn't it? I mean, isn't that kind of like as a culture? I think that, I mean, you sort of touched on it already, but like it just in terms of like cultural okay, like cultural norm, it's becoming okay for us to say that one day a year it's important for this thing. And we've been so let down by the system, all of us, not just, I mean, that we're okay with, we're like, okay, yeah, you broke all these social contracts with us. We're okay with you saying that one day a year we have to care about one specific group of trafficked humans. And
yeah, I also think, at least for, I mean, my age, I'm in my late 40s, you know, we grew up on the narrative of stranger danger, right? Mm-hmm. And yeah. I think that so many of us still want the world to be that clear and easy, meaning very defined evil people, mm-hmm. very defined good people. I know who they are. I know who's a stranger to me. When the reality is that strangers are way less likely statistically to sexually assault you. Right. It's actually people you know and trust. And that's true about trafficking as well. There's mm-hmm. a myth that traffickers, right, are snatching people and putting them in trafficking situations, when 97% of my cases, my clients knew their trafficker prior to being trafficked. And that's the same thing with Janelle Grant, right? She met him and was groomed by him, according to the indictment, or I mean, the filing, before she was trafficked by him. And so that pattern that we see in the accusation there is the same pattern I see in almost all of my cases.
Yes. And then, so can you touch a little bit on one of the things that we have seen come up because of this lawsuit and just in general related to trafficking is, can you talk to about the Mann Act a little bit, kind of explain what that is and how that comes into play with trafficking?
Oh, I wasn't expecting this question.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's fine. It's like, I mean, it's a super nerdy, like, legal question.
I'm into, so, let's go super nerdy legal. Well,
it's definitely something that's come up. And I believe it's mentioned in Janelle's lawsuit, if I remember correctly. And so...
So, I mean, talk to me about what your question is about the Mann Act, because I may go like way too deep on the Mann Act. So what is it that people are curious, like, what are you curious about?
I think some people just don't really know what it is, or that they know that it involves like that for the Mann Act, I guess, to be in effect, that there has to be transportation over state lines for the purpose of some sort of sexual act with someone.
Yeah. So the Mann Act, and apologies for the nerding out for a minute.
I'm excited.
The Mann Act actually grows out of this, what they often call the white slavery hysteria, meaning that women were being spirited across state lines to have their virtue taken advantage of. There's also a number of people who believe that it's actually the Mann Act that... by putting up different offices around the country to try to enforce the Mann Act, that helps lead to the development of the modern day FBI. So the Mann Act has this really interesting history. I don't actually think of it as the history of the trafficking law, and I'll tell you why in a minute. Okay. But it actually has this really interesting history in around the hysteria that still accompanies trafficking law, mm-hmm. and also the privileging of certain victims, right? It was called the White Slavery Act because what we cared about, right, were white women being harmed, not other people potentially being mm-hmm. harmed. And so, yes, the act really says that if you are spiriting someone across a state line,
Does it really say spiriting in the act?
No, but I mean,
I know. I'm just curious because sometimes with some of the older cases, there's literally that kind of wording. So it's fun sometimes.
The state of Michigan has fascinating history about our laws. Like, it wasn't until maybe less than 10 years ago that like even a man could be charged with prostitution because all of the prostitution laws were gendered in this state. So how to say it, so if you were a male involved in the commercial sex industry, you were charged with like, you know, public indecency. Like you had to like fiddle around with these different charges. Anyway, so really interesting stuff there. But the history of the Trafficking Victims Protection Act actually grows out of laws against slavery. Okay, so the 13th Amendment against slavery is passed, and then we have laws against debt. Bondage, peonage, and then we have a law against involuntary servitude. And the law against involuntary servitude stands for quite a long time and is really effective. Until a farmer in Chelsea, Michigan, actually holds two men who, the language of the case is, had very low IQ, and they were held and forced to work without pay, and they were psychologically coerced. I mean, I actually think there's evidence in the case that they were also physically beaten, but that's not. So these two people, these two kind of older people in Chelsea, Michigan, were charged with involuntary servitude. They're convicted. They take the case all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court in U.S. versus Kosminski says, gosh, this is really bad, but there's no physical force here. And for it to be involuntary servitude, we have to see physical force. Okay.
Wow.
So then Congress says, whoa, we have to cover psychological coercion, because we know that in these cases of slavery, debt bondage, peonage, and involuntary servitude, psychological coercion happens all the time. So the Trafficking Victim Protection Act is passed very much in response to the Kosminski case and says, hey, under this act, we're incorporating all the stuff we knew about slavery, debt bondage, peonage, and involuntary servitude, and we're making crystal clear that psychological coercion is enough to hold someone in compelled service so that they can be charged criminally. So that's where we get the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. Yes, the Mann Act is part of that history, but it's really kind of over on the side of it.
Okay. Thank you for that. That was a really great understanding, because I think that people, they hear it and they're like myself, and they're like the very basics of how sometimes it can be applied. And I think that that is a case that, I mean, that might be, you know, especially as we're hearing bigger cases related to human and sex trafficking. I mean, obviously there was Sean Combs this morning. Mike Jeffries, the former CEO of Abercrombie and Fitch, was arrested in relation to sex trafficking charges. So I feel like that this is a term that's probably going to come up, that people are probably, they like, I've heard of it, but I don't really know what it means or how it relates. So that's why I wanted to ask that. And thank you. That was,
I'm glad
that was great.
I'm glad you did, because now I'm gonna end up in a click hole on that about it.
Right. And so
since you like this stuff, I actually found the address and like drove past the homestead, which still exists in the same way.
Oh, yeah. Wow. That's, I mean, that's the kind of thing I would definitely do.
Well,
I mean,
part of it is because I think based on movies like the movie Taken, Sound of Freedom, right? We have these really, really narrow conceptualizations of what it looks like for, like what the place looks like where someone's trafficked. And this just looks like your average, like rural home, brick, beautiful. Like you don't look at it and think, oh, evil happens there. Right. And I think we have to learn, right, what it looks like. And also what it looks like in a workplace setting, right, where someone is really doing something. You might have the language of trafficking. Like, I highly, highly doubt that any of the employees of the WWE who saw what was happening or who knew inklings of what were happening were like, I think that's human trafficking according to 18 USC, right? Blah, 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 blah.
Right.
And I am not going to say anything. No one's going to have that. But I'm guessing that some folks thought, that's not right. Something is wrong here. This person, there's a huge power differential here. Why is this happening? I wouldn't be comfortable with this myself, right? And my hope is that people listening to this will learn to speak up when that little niggling voice is inside of you that something's wrong. You don't have to know that it's called trafficking, right? You just have to recognize the power differential and the vulnerability and say something.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, definitely. Because you hear from people now who are like, I kind of thought something. And even she has said in the lawsuit, like, people knew something was up, but they didn't know what. And so they just kind of, they would not look at her. They wouldn't speak to her. They just kind of compartmentalized it and just went about their business. And, you know.
And you know what that really speaks to is that traffickers are really good at dehumanizing people, and we're really good at going along with them.
Yeah.
Right. And I see this in case after case after case. Someone gets dehumanized by a trafficker, right? And if the allegations are true in this case, Vince McMahon dehumanized her, right? He treated her as an object for his pleasure and other people's pleasure and paid her money for that, right? The commercial benefit. So if that's true, and then other people are like, okay, I don't know what's going on here, but I will adopt the dehumanization. Right? They don't realize they're doing it. But instead, I ask people to think of, if you have that niggling feeling that something's off, what would you want someone to do if that was your best friend? Right? What would you want someone to do if that was someone you cared about in your life? Gosh, I sure want someone to speak up. At a minimum, someone to go up to Janelle and say, are you okay? Are you okay?
Yeah.
Right.
But if we look at the Rolling Stone, if we look at the Rolling Stone article that just dropped over the weekend, where the six writers came out and talked about like this almost dictatorship that was going on inside. That he not only was dehumanizing her, he was terrorizing everybody else into not saying anything. I mean, saying mm-hmm. something in that environment sounds like it would have been hostile for that person too.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I think that that article seemed to, from the writers I mean, that they spoke to, so that there was a, he sowed an environment of fear. Like that was, that theme kept coming out throughout the interview. And so if there's that fear there for their job or retaliation, and because they were saying that people would like the only time people would laugh is when somebody was being made fun of or made a joke out, and they said, you know, your own coworkers wouldn't stick up for you because then they would become the target. So it seems like it was just that very much. And so he had already allegedly created this environment of fear, so then that he could easily get away with doing the things that he was doing, because people were afraid to say anything or afraid that if they point it out, then perhaps he sets his sights on them and then they become that, you know. So it definitely sounds like he created the circumstances and the environment to be able to do the things that he was doing.
I haven't read the article, so I mean, I believe you. Everything you're saying sounds very consistent with these kinds of spaces. But I also hope that shows people who raise questions of like, why didn't she leave? Why didn't she speak out? Why didn't, you know, why didn't? Well, that's a whole office full of people who were not being harmed in the, you know, in the atrocious ways it's alleged that she was harmed,
right,
who couldn't do the basic thing and try to help someone who was being hurt way more than them. So I'm not, I hope that those kinds of comments about that workplace environment show people how easy it is to be in these environments and not speak up, not know how to get out of it, not know what to do. Because I feel like what happens in these scenarios is that everyone wants to pull apart the thoughts, actions, choices of the survivor, rather than pulling apart the thoughts, actions, choices of the perpetrator and those around them.
Absolutely.
I also hope it means that many of them will speak up now in support of women who come forward, because maybe you didn't speak up then, but I sure hope you speak up now.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details. At Kroger Pharmacy, care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Now, if you're in a situation as a worker and you are like, you have that feeling and you think that one of your coworkers is being abused in some way, or, I mean, regardless of the circumstance, but you know that it's a hostile environment, who do you go to?
So, I mean, I think there's lots of options. I think one is, if you think, oh, it's this, you know, I heard this podcast, this might be trafficking, there's a National Human Trafficking Hotline, 1-888-373-7888. And you can call and just say, like, this is happening. I don't know what to call it. I don't know what to tell this person who's being harmed, and they can give you resources. I think the other thing is, in this era of cell phones and ways that we can communicate all sorts of times outside of the workplace environment, mm-hmm. even a simple, a simple thing like, hey, you seemed upset today. Are you okay? I'm here to listen, kind of thing. Traffickers often isolate people. And I think the descriptions of what happened to Janelle support mm-hmm. that, right? That she was mm-hmm. so isolated in many ways. And my clients talk about it too, that gosh, you know, I have a number of clients I've represented who were forced to braid hair in a hair braiding salon for many years. And they were kids when they started. And one of my clients talks about how one of her longtime hair salon clients said, you know what, Sophia, you've been 18 for 3 years. Ha 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 ha. And my client, who was not yet 18, because she started braiding when she was like 12 and she was only 15 at the time, said, why did she laugh at that? Like, why didn't she see me? Right? Like think about the intimacy of braiding someone's hair. You're so sure. close to them. You are touching them for hours on end.
Right.
And so I think so often traffickers are just super effective and we go right along with it, of the isolation, the dehumanizing, and that's what makes it happen.
Or you're in that situation or any situation similar where you're like, well, I come here and get my hair done. There's no way they would be trafficking someone. Like, this is dry. Like, you wouldn't try to be like, justify it. Like, I've been coming here for years. I know them well enough that I trust them. I give them money and they would never do anything like that. And so you don't realize the part that you're playing in it.
Yeah. And the other reality is, you know, the WWE is not unique in this way. The only way these toxic work cultures happen all over the place is that a bunch of people agree to keep doing
it. Yep.
Right. I mean, like, I'm not trying to point the finger at any individual, but if enough of them stood up and said, like, I'm not doing this anymore, right? Like, I'm not doing this anymore.
So right.
I'm not working here. I'm not that sort of, like McMahon, Vince could not do this by himself. Like, this doesn't happen by himself.
Right.
This doesn't. Definitely it can't. Not.
Right. It can't.
That's why we remind people that the suit includes the company. A lot of people even want to like compartmentalize even the case when we're talking about it. And we are constantly reminding everyone and WWE, like everyone kind of wants that.
They think because Vince McMahon is no longer in the company, Don Laurinaitis is no longer in the company, that means the problem is solved and it's bad. The bad guy's gone. So
stranger danger. Right. We got rid of the stranger.
Well, that's how they're selling it.
Yeah. Yes, they definitely are. And you can see the ways that we've talked about people that they use as like the public face of their company. They use his Vince McMahon's son-in-law, Paulo Beck, who is a former wrestler, but is now he's the CEO, the COO, and he's their public face that they use. And that's we know him. He's been around for decades and we trust him because he's been here and we know him and he used to be a wrestler. And so I think that people think, okay, this is, he took over and everything's perfect now. And it's a great work environment. And this stuff still, that the problem solved, it couldn't still possibly be happening, you know, because we have no idea what's happening in that workplace. And I don't want to accuse them of anything, but like, I think people think the problem has been solved and there is no further issues that is happening. Yeah. And then that just kind of, you know, perpetuates more of the issue. And I want to go back to something that you had talked about. And we've talked about that a lot because a lot of people say, well, why didn't Janelle leave? Why didn't this person leave? And can you kind of help people understand what would make someone A, stay in a trafficking situation, and B, see in this lawsuit, we see how she talks about Vince was giving her gifts. He would go shopping and come back with, you know, a cashmere sweater, or he would do these things to her, or he would praise her, or he'd ask her opinions on what she thought about the show and would text her back during the show. He was surprised. Oh, he's so busy. And he still took time to respond to my text message. So how does that play into staying in these situations?
Yeah. So first off, I just want to reiterate that I think we always should be asking about what the perpetrator did, right? Like, there's no requirement that for you to be a victim that you leave at the first opportunity, that you speak up, that you push back, right? Because the law says the behavior of the perpetrator is the thing that's illegal. So I just want to caption that, right?
Yes.
Thank you.
At the same time, there are some very real I might often say also say rational reasons why someone who has the life experiences of Janelle and who met Vince when Janelle did stays. Now, so from my reading of the filing, right, like her parents just die, she's economically vulnerable, she's likely feeling very lost. And so here's this person who's paying attention to her, right? Who doesn't do all the bad stuff right away. And this is what's so important, right? This concept of like grooming, you know, so like this idea of like, I'm going to test a little bit of what happens and like, I'm going to throw you a little bit of a curveball, see if you react. And it's so easy in that first time to go like, I didn't like that joke, or I didn't like that thing someone said, but otherwise they're a good, like, look who he is. Like other, like I'm going to rationalize it. Well, then once the perpetrator realizes that that's okay, right, that you're going to get away with that, you're going to raise the stakes. While also at the same time, often raising the attention, the gifts, the money, you know, right, solving the issues of vulnerability that you have, whether it's economic or attachment, right? We didn't even talk about the need for attachment as a vulnerability that traffickers
have. Sure.
It's one of the most common ones I see. And so, and then you're in it, right? You have this job, your income is reliant on it. And then you've likely done some things that you feel a lot of shame about and that he has a lot of evidence about. And then he starts shaming you, right? He starts treating you in a way that tells you that he's openly saying like you're trash or, you know, something like that. Right. And then your self-esteem takes a huge dip. And then you wonder, if I'm trash, where can I go? My parents are dead. I'm not good for anything other than how he treats me. What am I going to do? Mm-hmm. And I don't know what would she have done? Might he have threatened her? You know, like, we don't know. And so I think, to me, as someone who represents these individuals all the time, I think it is so rational that she stayed. Like, I was like, of course she would stay. And then it's also that you're like, okay, if I'm in it, maybe he really does have an attachment with me. And maybe I really do like there are good moments, right? Can I just focus on the good moments? And, you know, I have many clients who say they love their perpetrator, right? It's not love in the way I, with a healthy attachment, would define love, right? But we're not talking about healthy attachment love. We're talking about people with unhealthy attachments who are searching and who've been taken advantage of. And so here's the reality. Traffickers use that unhealthy attachment and the trauma that people have had before they encountered them against them. And if we ask the question of why didn't she leave, we're doing the same thing as the trafficker, period.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah. Definitely. And one of the questions that also kind of that I had was, how do you like, or can you talk about a little bit about the role that in a law enforcement plays when it comes to handling claims of human trafficking, because it's obviously it's a bit different from this tend to handle it differently when it's a child involved versus an adult, because an adult, you know, I think there's a lot of mindset of, you know, they're an adult, they can make their decisions, they can get out of this if they want to. So then they can be brushed off and things like that until it gets to a really extreme point. So what can law enforcement do to kind of recognize that a human trafficking situation is in its early stages, or follow through even on what an adult is saying?
Well, first off, I want to say I work with tons of law enforcement that I respect deeply, that I'm so impressed with their work. And at the end of the day, law enforcement priorities reflect community priorities. So that's really important to remember. Mm-hmm. When we start wondering about why they engage in certain things and they don't engage in other things, it's because we as a community have decided that certain things are priorities. So I'm not sure I would agree with part of your question.
Okay.
We have many cases involving kids that law enforcement don't take as a priority because they involve Black and brown kids, kids from poverty, kids who are addicted to drugs. And so, again, we have created a hierarchy of victims in the sex trafficking space and the human trafficking space more broadly. And so, you know, in Michigan, we actually have a state law that says if you're 16 or 17 years old and you're involved in the commercial sex industry, you're presumed to be a victim of human trafficking as long as, quote, you substantially comply with court ordered services, end quote, which means your victimization doesn't hinge on your exploitation. It hinges on your obedience to the legal system. So it's like it has put into statute this belief that real victims behave a certain way,
right?
Not that certain acts of exploitation create real victims. Mm-hmm. So we have not transitioned even around kids to this idea that all people who are treated a certain way, who have been exploited, are victims. So I just want to catch that.
Sure.
But I think the real answer is we as a community, right? Almost every community or most communities or most counties have a domestic violence shelter. We don't have a place for most trafficking victims if they're identified at 2 a.m. for law enforcement to safely put them. That's not a jail cell. Mm-hmm. Until we do,
right?
Law enforcement is going to continue to make the choices that they're making, because mm-hmm. I get it. If it's 2 a.m. and I have encountered an adult woman, let's say, who might be addicted to drugs, who might have a third party manager who is threatening her, even if she wants to get off the streets, what am I supposed to do with her at 2 a.m.?
Yeah.
I can take her to jail and I may tell myself that keeps her safer. And it actually might objectively keep her safer for 24 hours. I would make the argument it makes her more vulnerable and less safe long term because that's on her record. So like, we can talk about short term safety and long term safety.
Sure.
But you know what? You tell me at 2 a.m. what you're going to do faced with that person, knowing that if you walk away, she might get beaten or something else. And so those are we as communities have not given law enforcement the right choices if we care about trafficking. We just haven't. And until we do, we can't expect them to do anything different.
Yeah.
I actually have a friend out in Colorado who runs a women's and girls, for women and girls specifically, having been trafficked. She has upgraded to a little village, but she's been doing it for about 8 years. And one of the things that I talked to her about is that they're the resource. Right. They are it. It's if you're lucky enough in your community to mm-hmm. have a person like her and her partner who said, we want to do this, you are lucky enough in that area to have that person to call at 2 a.m. Yeah. But it's just like a lot of things, it's become way too incumbent on nonprofits and social organizations to pick up the slack. We're overfunding law enforcement almost like ad nauseum. And yet it's like you said, it's community priorities. We're focused on the silly things we're focused on. But it's, I thought about it when she and I were talking, because I was like, what about all the communities who don't have a resilience rising? Mm-hmm. Like they, and there's tons of them, like mine doesn't.
Yeah. I mean, I often say, look, the clients who make it to the clinic, they've like won the lottery, right? Like,
right.
And that doesn't mean that it's because we're such amazing lawyers, although my students are amazing lawyers. Like, but they've won the lottery because they have free, excellent, dedicated legal services it's just not available everywhere. And so, law enforcement will be like, your clients like stick around, blah, blah, blah. You know why they stick around? Because we keep showing up for them, right? We show up all the time. We show up. And that's just not realistic for like a nonprofit struggling to keep its doors open. Like, I don't have to go out hat in hand collecting cash to keep the doors of Michigan Law School open. Thank goodness, right? I can focus on teaching students and helping them be the best lawyers ever for these survivors of human trafficking. But there's tons of cases we can't take on because we don't have capacity.
Yeah, it's community priorities at the end of the day. That's all it is. I mean, you've said it all along, and that's so many things. So it's yikes.
Right. And then Ed, I want to go back to something that is in your bio. You say that you help to like reintegrate victims by developing legal solutions to address, all the, because this is an extremely complex situation that obviously we can't solve just by having, somewhere to take somebody at 2 a.m. and things like that. There's a lot of things that have to change, and even society, how they see what human trafficking is, and especially like you said, when it involves labor and things like that. So what is that? So how exactly do you do that? Or like, what are some of the initiatives and things that that you do to help them?
Yeah. So sort of all over the map. I mean, like one of them is that for a long time, it was the case that if you got sort of like forfeiture, like say, let's say you worked at a strip club and you're forced to work at a strip club, and then there was a criminal case, got some cash back to you. The IRS treated that as income that you failed to pay when you were being trafficked.
Of course they did.
Right? But like, so we don't view our work at the trafficking clinic as stopping sort of at the moment of rescue, right? The moment of rescue is like objectively almost the easiest moment in the entire case. We know how to go into buildings and tear people out. What we don't know how to do is to help their brains heal from that experience and also how to help them build lives after the fact. So we're like, well, that's not okay, right? It can't be that you now have this massive tax bill. And then if you're a foreign national, that means you didn't pay your taxes, which means you might not be able to get your immigration status. So one of the things we just do all the time is we stick with our clients for so long. I mean, we joke that like we sometimes still help our first client ever, like if something happens. And so we're really looking at that whole thing. So another thing that some traffickers do in addition to trafficking people is destroy their credit. And so we view as part of our job is helping people rebuild that credit. There's actually now some things in the law that make that a lot easier. Another piece is a lot of our sex trafficking clients have many convictions related to commercial sex work on their record. So great that you're out of this sex trafficking situation, but who's going to hire you? And aren't you going to feel a ton of shame likely if you have to go to your job and there's a background check? Or even let's say you don't have to have a job for some reason, but you want to go volunteer at your kid's school and they're going to run a background check, right? That's like that's embarrassing for some people. You know, I actually happen to have the same name as a sex worker in another part of the country. And many times her record gets paired with my name. And I don't get upset about it because I can, you know, easily prove it's not me and all of that. But it is a personal reminder to me of how this can affect people in all sorts of spaces. It was when I wanted to volunteer my kids' preschool. And so I guess that's that last sentence in my bio is really about so many people think about anti-trafficking work as that moment of rescue. Mm-hmm. And we actually think about it as this much longer thing of like, how do people build a life? And how can we help them build a life? And I actually think it's one of the reasons that I can still find so much joy in the work, because for folks who only work at the moment of rescue, you really only know someone at one of the worst moments of their lives. Mm-hmm. But I get to hear about like the college graduations and the marriages and the babies and just the like, hey, Bridget, I had a great day. And that's what really can fuel you in this work, because I get to see people in their full humanity, not just in the moment when they were totally dehumanized.
Right. You're right. Yeah. That's incredible. It's incredible work. And I can, and like one of the things that we have heard several times through Ann Callis, which is Janelle Grant's lawyer, is that she is still suffering from suicidal ideation. There are weeks at a time where she cannot leave her home. And I think that is something that people kind of think like, okay, well, they're out of that situation, so that's the end of it. And they don't realize that there's years of trauma that they have to not undo, but to kind of integrate and to try to work with. Yeah, process, exactly.
Yeah, and actually, you know, I'm super impressed that, I mean, I don't know Janelle Grant. I've never spoken to Janelle Grant, but I'm super impressed that she even filed this, because reality is that this process destroys people. Mm-hmm. This legal process destroys people. And
forever.
Especially to go up against such a big name, someone who has a literal fan base, right? Like a literal fan base, not just like, it might be that people favor him. Like he has a literal fan base.
Right.
And so to do that, like very few people can do it. Mm-hmm. And then even fewer can survive it. And even fewer than that, even if they survive it, can become whole on the other side of it. Mm-hmm. So she has a massive, massive job in front of her. And so I can't convey enough how much like it's not, she can't even be in the processing right now of what she has, because she is being re-traumatized as this case is happening.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I think that's something that people don't think about. And we've talked about a lot about, because the case has stayed through December at this point. And then, you know, there's also the civil stuff and there's so much. And like, she's even just trying to get her own medical records of what has happened to her, and like and just how, because, you know, obviously any of us could just go to the doctor and ask for our records and get them right there on the spot. And she's having to use legal methods. Obviously there's reasons why they're not wanting to be forthcoming with this information, but like, it just, even that is, she can't even do a basic, have a basic right of access to her records without getting, you know, a legal filing involved to access that.
Also, just imagine, let's say she wants to go get a job or volunteer somewhere and someone Googles her. Imagine this, like the worst thing that's ever happened to you being available via Google for everyone in the world to see.
Right. Right. And that's something that Mel and I have talked about a lot, is just having the courage to admit to herself what happened to her, yeah, then to be brave enough to tell someone, then to take the step of talking to a lawyer, and then filing legal work, knowing that because of who the perpetrator is, he is so well known. And even if it is in this little wrestling bubble, even people outside of wrestling probably know, have heard the name Vince McMahon. At least if you live in the US, you probably at least know he, oh wait, that's, isn't that that wrestling guy? Like, and so too, she knows that she is, well, not welcoming, but all this stuff is coming at her because people are, they will defend him because this is somebody that they've seen on their television screens for, you know, four decades. And they're like, and, you know, and she's just opening herself up to so much. And I can't, and these are, and this is just what we know with Janelle. There's so many people like Janelle who every single day have to be brave and talk to people and admit what happened to them, and then seek out help or figure out what to do.
Piece is, she likely, again, I've never spoken with her, but she likely also had to deal with, she probably has some sort of attachment to him.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And so to do this means to cast this person that you have really complex feelings about in such a bad light.
Right. Well, I mean, you made the point earlier about the grief situation, and I have had significant losses in my life and had grief. And that feeling that you have when you're in that place, and then that first person comes along that is that, like, I mean, it's so insidious.
And so insidious.
So for me, very much when I was like, she had just lost her parents, like you said, it was the easiest thing in the world for me to understand why, actually, unfortunately, because all those, everyone says it's seven steps. It's like, no, it's seven things that you cycle through periodically after the, and grief comes in all different, you know, obviously this is a grieving situation for her because of, like you said, she has an attachment to him. She has to try and make a life. There's many.
Right. And grief also with how are you going to survive economically? Right. Right. Like, exactly. That combo.
Especially with no help here for more than anything, especially, I mean, it's not to underplay anybody else, but for women and children, and then especially marginalized. My friend made the point of the further out in the margins you get pushed, the further away help and treatment and escape gets, because the resources, essentially what little resources there are, dry up the further away from the, like, it's some of these mainstream people that, like with Diddy and all of the, that'll get some attention right now.
Yep.
But all these other people who are in the same situation, but like you said, often are Black and brown, are poor, are, I mean, it's,
yeah. And it's also, I mean, even how we talk about that, I'm not critiquing you, but even how we have as a culture, a language around this, like human, like people at the margins, it's almost saying, like, if humanity is the center, they're stepping away from their humanity. And that's, and that's actually how we treat them. Right. So we have a culture of dehumanization. That makes the job of traffickers so much easier, because first they have to turn someone into a commodity and then they profit from it, right? And if we're already doing that commodity work for them, right? If we call people illegals, if we put people way far out at the margins and don't think that they have a humanity and a dignity that must be respected with a basic level of survival, gosh, traffickers only have one job left to do, which is to exploit that dehumanization. And I say this all the time. We're a culture that does a really good job of supporting traffickers.
Yeah, we make their job awfully easy.
We do.
Terrifying.
Definitely. Yes. And so I guess, Mel, if you have any other questions, is there anything that you would like to add, Bridget, to this conversation that we didn't ask or just want people to know before we end this?
No, I just appreciate you bringing this to your audience. I also think, you know, it can be complex, even around perpetrators. No one, not even perpetrators, are the worst things they've ever done. I mean, that's the reality. Someone can do really, really awful things and be a great dad or a great husband or a great friend or provide entertainment that people really love. And I think I'm not here defending perpetrators, but I actually think if I believe that, you know, that there's a shared sense of humanity that requires everyone have dignity, like everyone, right? And so we can say that someone who we've enjoyed being entertained by did these awful things, and we also acknowledge that we enjoyed being entertained by them. It's not either or.
Yeah, definitely. Yes. Thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it so much. And I think this conversation hopefully will help so many people. And, you know, if we have more questions, maybe we'll have you back at some point. But we appreciate this so much. Thank you for your time.
Have a good day.
Thank you, too.
Thank you so much.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.